I'm Matthew Goldberg with Bankrate. On behalf of Cebu, welcome to today's webinar on covering the election on the business desk. We have a great moderator and panel on the line, and this should be an excellent discussion where we'll talk about what business journalists should be looking at leading up to November. Our moderator today is Fred Muniak. Fred is a business editor at the Associated Press. For more than 10 years, he has supervised AP reporters who cover the economy, the housing industry, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, and financial regulatory institutions. Joining us as panelists today are Carrie Levine, senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Carrie investigates the influence of money in politics. Before joining the center, she worked as research director at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Bill Steiden, the investigative and business editor at the Des Moines Register, is also with us. Bill participated in coverage of the Iowa caucuses. His careers also include stops at the Columbus Dispatch, the Sarasota Herald Tribune, and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. To our listeners, if you have a question for the panel, you should be able to drop it in the chat here. And also feel free to use hashtag Cebu on Twitter. With that, I'll hand things over to Fred Muniak. Fred?
Okay, thank you very much, Matthew, and welcome to everybody. This has been, I don't have to remind you, a extraordinary year for all of us in the news business. We've had at least two events happen which are seem generational, once in a generation events, from the pandemic to the eruption of protests over police brutality. And it seems like we've been focused on these two stories, it feels like forever. But then there's also another big event this year, which is a presidential election, which is fast approaching in just a few months. There's no doubt that the coronavirus and the racial protests are going to seep into the election. But I think as business journalists, we also have to keep our eye on the ball that this is also going to be an election in which the candidates are going to try to portray the state of the economy or the state of the business world in a way that is favorable to them and unfavorable to their opponents. So I'm hopeful that our panelists will help us see through these challenges and maybe help strategize the reporting and the story planning that many of you are already thinking about as we head closer and closer to an extraordinary election season, which will probably be like none other we've ever experienced. So what we'll try to do today is, through your questions and through the insights of our panelists, try to help all of you think through how to approach, how to plan covering the election through the prism of business and economics without becoming too deeply drawn into politics. It's probably a pitfall to veer so far in the direction of the political back and forth that we lose sight of the fact that there are very real economic issues that affect ordinary households every day, and focusing on those issues and illuminating them for people outside the fog of the political environment, I think is an important function for all of us. So I'm hopeful that we can sort of delve into some of these issues today. So I don't know if we've got any questions forthcoming, but until we do, maybe the panelists would like to offer some thoughts of their own about how they would strategize the whole planning of covering the election through the eyes of business and economics. So, Carrie, would you like to offer any thoughts on that?
Sure. Hi. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Thanks to everyone for joining me on the panel. I'm really looking forward to hearing what everyone else has to say, too. So one thing that I would say is, as someone who has covered money and politics for a long time, is that it's going to be important to remember that business is a stakeholder in the outcome of the election. With every new administration, with every new Congress, comes a new policy agenda, and business is going to be very concerned about the outcome of this election, especially since the country is in the grip of as Fred pointed out, several crises that could shape the economy and could shape the business environment for a long time. So it matters a lot to the businesses that you cover, to the workers that you cover, who wins this election. And so right there, you have a really important intersection between business and the election. They have a lot of reasons to care about the outcome. And so I think then the question becomes, okay, well, how do you cover that? And one is, of course, the traditional way, by looking at the policies proposed by the candidate, how they'd affect the business community, how they'd affect the workers in your community. But I'd also argue that it's important to cover what business is doing to shape the outcome of the election. And that's where money and politics can come in. Businesses, can choose to give to super PACs that are going to spend millions and millions of dollars influencing the outcome of these elections. They can choose to give money through less visible means to nonprofit groups, through trade industry groups that will also spend millions of dollars shaping the outcome of these elections. They can sponsor conventions and throw parties at conventions so they can mingle with lawmakers. There's a lot of ways in which the business community is going to be engaging directly, really directly, with the outcome of this election. And so I think it's going to be important for business reporters who know these companies really well, who know their needs, who know their wants, to keep an eye on that. What are they hoping to do? Are they hoping to shape party platforms in some way? Because that happens in very little notice meetings at a convention. That's something that's maybe ripe for some scrutiny. Are they hoping to court a candidate through fundraising, a Senate candidate, a House candidate, a local candidate? Do they show a flood of money coming in from employees of a certain company on a certain date that might tell you there was some kind of fundraiser? And so I think it's really important to read the tea leaves and look at how the businesses that you cover in your local community are trying to engage with this election. And I'm hoping we can talk about some ways to do that.
Thanks, Carrie. Bill, you bring a different perspective as an editor for a state and regional publication that obviously has to think closely about its own unique audience as opposed to, say, a national audience. Iowa and the Midwest has its own issues in terms of business, in terms of economics, in terms of politics. How do you approach something like this, the planning for covering an election through the prism of the business world?
Sure. Well, I think the, Kerry covered an awful lot of it. The one thing that I think I might add is we have made a big effort when we have done extensive reporting on issues of particular interest here to try to make sure we get business perspectives included, in part just because we want to get them on the record and get some kind of a position statement from them. One of the interesting things we've seen, for instance, is we've done a lot of reporting about the inadequacy of childcare and childcare regulation in Iowa. And by engaging with the business councils here, we've actually planted the seed that resulted in them going to the legislature and saying, we want to see a big subsidy for childcare enacted in this legislative session because we can't get enough workers into the workforce here because there just isn't, there aren't good childcare options for them. So those sorts of efforts to engage the business community can actually get some results and some issues on the plate.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I will add as well as someone who covers oversees economics coverage, obviously a global news organization. One of the themes that we have sort of explored over the years, and it's something that I think all people, all reporters who cover the economy can remind themselves of, is that there's going to be a fight over the state of the economy as one of sort of the animating themes of this election. And it's very important, I believe, to keep in mind that averages don't really tell the story. We at the AP, we have a catchphrase we use to remind ourselves of this, which is average isn't typical. And it's another way of saying, you know, comparing averages with medians. And increasingly, as, you know, the wealth gap and income gap have widened in the United States, as middle income or middle class jobs have been kind of hollowed out, there are more jobs at the top of the scale and more jobs at the lower end of the scale and fewer in the middle. The word average has ceased to really apply to very many people who, you know, among our readerships. So what I would encourage people who cover these issues is to ask themselves, you know, where do our readers fall in this whole scheme? If for example, stock market is going up and 401ks are going up and candidates are sort of arguing over this, what proportion of your readers have 401ks and what are the average sizes of their 401ks? The fact is that only about half of Americans have any exposure to the stock market, even through 401ks. And even among those who do have exposure to the stock market, they have very, very low balances relative to the average, because the average is brought up so much by the top heaviness of wealth in this country. So in portraying the economy, the candidates are going to argue over, well, unemployment is this, and 401ks are that, and wages are this. But all of these metrics, all these barometers are deeply and in fact increasingly skewed by how much of it goes to those at the top, whether it's the top 1%, the top 5%, the top 10%. I mean, you know, one figure that brings this out is 80% of the stock market wealth in this country, roughly 80%, give or take, is held by about 10% of the population. So the rest of the 90%, share the rest, which isn't very much. So reminding yourselves that averages don't tell the story, and that the people at the median are often your target, or should be your target for covering how the economy is treating, you know, the readers or the viewers, you know, your news organization serves. Bill, as someone who deals with state, local, regional coverage, have you had occasion to have these discussions? I'm curious with your reporters about, you know, how your readers might, you know, compare with national averages and how that might affect the way you cover these stories for your readers.
Yes, well, before everything changed, one of the big issues here has been that we had something beyond full employment, and the big difficulty here was finding enough people in the labor pool, particularly to fill the service sector jobs. It's informed a lot of discussions, particularly about housing. We've got a lot of service sector jobs in the suburbs and very little housing that's affordable for people there. And we've endeavored to bring that to the attention of the lawmakers and the local governments in those areas. So we've been working on trying to point up where the gaps are, and the fact that they keep enacting policies that just make it harder and harder to build affordable housing here. And that's prompted some reaction from readers who piled on to say they're in favor of more affordable housing, or at least discussing the issue and the pros and cons of it. And it has become a discussion among some of the candidates as well, the need to broaden the labor pool.
Right. I mean, when you hear about wage increases, for example, do your readers or do your reporters ever, you know, discuss or delve into the issue of whether the wage increases that might be occurring at the national level are seeping into your readership and making a difference in their lives or not?
Yeah. That's kind of a fraught issue in Iowa because of the rural-urban gap.
Right.
Des Moines is a very prosperous town, and wages tend to be higher on average, to use that word, here
right.
than in the rest of the state. On the other hand, you've got large, you know, swaths of rural population and very low wages, and a lot of interest in keeping those wages as low as they can go. So our minimum wage in Iowa continues to be the federal minimum wage, which is what, $7.25 an hour, something like that.
Something
amount. There's been very little interest at the legislative level in addressing that, even though there have been at least some movements within the metro area here to try to establish local higher minimum wages. But the legislature has made it pretty clear that they'll do anything they can to stop that from happening. So that really hasn't gained a lot of traction.
Right. But it seems like you are pointing out, though, kind of your own sort of averages and typical in a sense, exactly. Because, you know, Des Moines is so much an entity unto itself relative to the rural areas of the state that, if you know, if there are any averages about, you know, what wages are doing or what jobs are doing in your state, they probably apply very little to the people, you know, way outside of the Des Moines area.
For us, the issues that people can get together around tend to be the ones that, quite frankly, flow downstream. Iowa, this is kind of a call it the poop state. There is so much fertilizer applied to farm fields upriver from us that are drained by what they call tiles, the agricultural drainage systems, into the rivers that flow down into the city, that the city has had to invest in incredibly expensive technology to purify the water here.
Right.
And that is an issue that indeed there's willingness to address at both ends, not only here, but in the rural area as well. Mm-hmm. So there's, that is, you know, those sorts of issues bring the two sides together. Have been ones that we've been able to get some traction on as far as getting positions to weigh in on.
Right. Let's switch gears over to Kerry, but before I do, I just want to remind participants to please pose your questions in the chat room. We have, you know, two panelists with a lot of expertise in different areas, and they'd be happy to help you think through any of the issues or questions that you're pondering at the moment. So, Kerry, you've covered money and politics for a number of years, and as you look ahead to this election season, what are some of the ways in which these issues have evolved over time? How is covering the election or an election season in 2020 through the prism of money different from how it's been in previous election cycles? What's changed in ways that people, you know, reporters and editors who are listening, taking part in this webinar would benefit from hearing about?
Oh, where do I even start with that? if you cover money and politics, it feels like some things change by the minute, and then some things never change. It's a very odd conundrum, which is maybe why I still find it interesting. I started out as a lobbying reporter and then wound up doing much more on campaign finance and ethics, and now on voting. And believe it or not, all those issues are really connected. So if you cover one, you kind of inevitably start covering the others. It's a little bit of a gateway drug situation. So I think that when I started covering money and politics, it was right at the post-Abramoff scandal period. And I don't know how many of our panelists are familiar with that, but that was a major lobbying scandal more than a decade ago, where a lobbyist had essentially courted members of Congress with trips and golf games. And, people went to jail. There was a major corruption scandal. Congress passed ethics reform legislation. And that's about when I started covering all this. And so at the time, lobbying was really under a very bright spotlight. People were talking about reforming the profession. Presidential candidates were denouncing lobbyists and I remember at the time, as kind of a baby lobbying reporter, I got my first taste of hypocrisy in politics because I did a story before the 2008 election about how Barack Obama and John McCain were running around denouncing lobbyists and talking about how they wouldn't take money from them. And then I went to New Hampshire, and who was sweeping up the gym after a John McCain rally but the lobbyists who were volunteering for his campaign? It was happening with Obama. And so that's when I really started to realize that everyone talks about money in politics, but you have to look at what they actually do, because there's just ways to slice that kind of issue really fine. And so I think what that means for the purposes of the people listening to this panel today is don't just look at what people say about how local businesses influence their campaign or their policies. Look at what they do. Look at how their positions evolve. Look at who they're taking money from. Look at who's sweeping up the gym after the campaign speech, you know, who's advising them and maybe isn't on the payroll, who's advising them behind the scenes. And so I really started to look for the daylight between what people say and what they actually do. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's an important thing in holding people accountable. And I don't mean to suggest that all politicians are liars or that people don't mean what they say. But what I do want to say is that these issues are really complicated. How politicians are influenced and who by is a really complex thing. And I think there's an open question as to whether sometimes you want politicians to be influenced by what they hear as they hear from different constituencies, right? But the business community is an especially touchy one because people don't, you know, especially right now for Democrats, it's a big issue to be in the pocket of Wall Street, right? To take money from Wall Street. It's a big issue to take money from companies that have spoken out on certain issues in certain ways. Businesses are dealing with the backlash of taking positions on social issues, which is something they maybe didn't used to do, and they're engaging with politics in new ways. And so I think that that's really interesting. And it's a really interesting thing to cover if you're a business reporter, because they wouldn't do it if they didn't think it was good business, I think. So right. I think it's really important to look at how things have changed, at the things companies are willing to say. And it's also important to say you're going to put your money where your mouth is. I did a story after the Charlottesville protests a couple of years ago. President Trump came out after the Charlottesville protests and said, well, there's good people on both sides. And he was really roundly denounced for the way he handled that. That was a really traumatic incident for the nation, what happened in Charlottesville. And a lot of companies came forward and said, well, we don't agree with him. We don't agree with what he's saying. And a lot of corporate leaders quit his advisory boards and denounced what he was saying. So I went back to all the companies that gave money to his inauguration and his convention and to the vice president's leadership pack. And I said, okay, are you still going to give? You know, you're denouncing this administration. You're saying that your company doesn't stand with him.
Right.
So the next time there's something you're eligible to give to that's connected to his inauguration, the next time your corporate PAC can make a contribution to the vice president's corporate PAC, the next time he has an inauguration or a convention raising money, are you going to give? And, you know, shockingly enough, no one wanted to answer that. Like, literally not one company would say anything except that that's a really speculative question. And so, you know, I actually don't think it's a speculative question, because I'll tell you, there's always another way that these politicians are raising money. And so my question was, that's, you know, so you said this, you're telling your stakeholders that this is where you stand on this, but are you still going to support this administration with your checkbook when there are ways to legally do that, or are you not? And, oh, well, we're going to have to see the best way for us to engage with this going forward, you know? No one really wanted to answer that. And that was actually not a really widely read story. Because sometimes you do stories and they get hundreds of thousands of people reading them, people get outraged. That one was not. But it was interesting because it was really important to me to do. Because I thought that they should have to answer the question. And so I think by now we all know what the answer is, right? It's later.
Right.
Companies have engaged with this administration in all kinds of different ways, some opaque, some transparent. But I think it's really important not to just take these statements and write them down and give it to them. I think it's really important to say to them, okay, well, that's great that you said that. I'm really interested in your opinion about that. And so also, are you going to do this other thing?
Right.
Or how is this going to change the way you engage with this public official?
Right.
And so, because I think that the companies always want to keep their options open.
Right.
But I think it's really important to view the kind of statements that companies and entities are making now with a critical eye and put them in the context of both past behavior and asking them how it's going to change what they do going forward.
Yeah, I mean, what you're describing, it seems to me, is just classic accountability journalism. It's what, you know, it's what all of us should be doing in one guise or another as we cover companies of any kind. What are they saying and what are they doing, right?
Yeah, and you know, I wish that story had gotten more readers. It's I was on vacation when Charlottesville happened. I was out of the country, and I was, you know, irked enough at the way all those statements were getting reported that I came back a couple of weeks later and still did it, right? I was still annoyed. And so
yeah.
I think the timing and other things contributed to it not being as well read. And I'm happy to send you all a link if you want to belatedly read my story. But I think that kind of thing is important because right now there is so much coming at us in terms of the news cycle that it's really hard to stop for a minute and make that 25 phone calls to a bunch of people who don't want to call you back, who don't want to answer your question. Yep. And say, well, wait a second, we're going to unpack this a little bit.
Right.
So I think it's all important for us to choose those moments where we can pause and do that.
Right.
Not just let people have the quick comment and move on.
So speaking of money in politics, there's a question, Carrie, that I think might be right up your alley. On the issue of regulation, financial regulation, obviously, after the 2008 financial crisis, there was, you know, a huge movement. You know, we got the Dodd-Frank legislation intact, and then, of course, it was watered down over time. The Trump administration, of course, has made a big deal about, you know, rolling back regulations of all kind. So a question comes in from one of our participants. Do we think financial regulation will be a part of the conversation in this election cycle? you know, the questioner suggests that it's unlikely, but what Wall Street does and what you know financial players do is always hugely important and has tremendous influence on the functioning of our financial system and our economy. And regulation, you know, properly instituted, plays a role. What do you think? What role do you think, if any, will financial regulation play in the 2020 election cycle?
I actually think that's a great question. I think it's always going to come up. And I think that right now there's sort of a wing of the Democratic Party that feels especially strongly about it. And Elizabeth Warren, I think, is a good example of a candidate that some of those folks really rallied behind, felt strongly about. I think it's clear that whether, you know, she's sort of rumored to be in the running as a vice presidential candidate, as vice presidential possibilities get vetted by the Biden team. I think whether or not she is picked, she will continue to have a voice. And this is a subject she's really spoken out on. So I'd be surprised if this doesn't come up. And I also think that in a lot of ways, as you point out, the Trump administration has taken the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in a different direction. They've made a lot of changes, regulatory changes, to varying degrees of effectiveness over the course of this administration, some of which are in the financial regulation area. And so I think it's very likely to come up. And I think broadly speaking, with the economy being such a central issue for voters, I think it's unlikely that it won't get touched on. And I also think that it's an area where the two candidates have widely differing visions. And so it's likely to get teased out somewhat. And I think that the financial community, your sort of big banks and things, is in a really interesting position as they try and kind of guide the discussion on that.
Right.
And figure out whether or not they're comfortable with where both these candidates are and how they kind of publicly engage in that, given the backlash, especially on the Democratic side, towards candidates who are seen as too close with financial institutions.
Right.
And, you know,
right.
Joe Biden has run into that criticism before, being from Delaware home to sort of your credit card companies and all of that. I think that financial secrecy is a big issue in the wake of the Panama Papers reporting. Mm-hmm. And I think that is likely to continue to come up. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of different ways this could come up during the election, whether it will be a central theme compared to, you know, getting people back to work,
right,
how the economy is doing overall, or what is a central theme. But I think it does also play into the central theme of inequality, just something that is just an overriding issue in American society today, and that people will be discussing through, you know, that will be the lens through which a lot of issues come up.
Right. So let me take a similar question to Bill. And just before I do, let me just remind participants to please put your questions forward so we can address whatever's on your mind or whatever you're curious about as you plan your election coverage through the prism of the business desk. Bill, what role does in your coverage or your planning for election coverage, what role does regulation play in a in Iowa, in small towns in your region, whether at the federal level or the state level? How do you see reporters sort of covering the issue of regulation against the backdrop of the coming election? Is this an issue that gets, brought up among the candidates?
I mean, during the caucuses, certainly, a buzz phrase was corporate accountability.
Sure.
What precisely candidates mean by that is a good question. Gary mentioned, Elizabeth Warren could list off 20 points about what she meant by that, but others were far vaguer and deliberately so, obviously. Nobody wants to make promises that they don't want to keep. We certainly found interest in that issue at all levels. And at least we know, we have a pretty good idea that when people talk about it, they have a good idea of what they mean. They mean that they're upset about the idea that there are privileged classes who they feel get away with whatever they want to get away with. Corporate is a code word for that. So I think there's an element of class warfare that plays into this. And that's probably worth exploring. There's a lot of resentment that is pent up. And I think there's some backlash forming in terms of folks who supported the current administration because they felt that, it was going to act against those kinds of special interests. They haven't seen that happen.
Bill, are there any specific regulations? The Trump administration paints with a broad brush. Regulations are bad. They need to be rolled back and give businesses a chance to move ahead. Are there specific regulations that you find people actually support and they specifically don't want these regulations rolled back, or is it too abstract?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And a really good example of that is ethanol in Iowa. That's a huge issue. Ethanol, almost half. I mean, we have the biggest corn crop in the country. Almost half of that corn crop goes into the production of ethanol. Now, the Trump administration, there is a regulation on the books that requires a certain amount of the nation's fuel supply have ethanol blended into it. The Trump administration has been giving exemptions right and left to refiners on that. And it has suppressed the market and has had a direct impact on farmers who are very upset about it. They want to see the regulation enforced, and they make a very strong statement about that. So that's a really good example of that, I would say. They're generally conservative. They generally, they don't want regulations on what they can do with the streams on their land and things like that. But they definitely want that final regulation upheld.
So
whose ox gets gored.
Exactly.
It's whose ox gets gored.
Exactly. So, Carrie, on the issue of money in politics, for reporters around the country who are covering, money in the political system or in the campaign system with a local eye, with a state eye, regional eye, where can they look? How do they find good stories on the subject of money and politics at the local level or the state level to find good stories that aren't in the sort of big data that you're probably looking at most of the time, but are sort of more targeted to their readers? How can they find good stories in data? What are some of the ways they can do that?
Okay, well, first of all, I hope every reporter is doing this because you all have a superpower I don't have, which is you know your communities, you know your local businesses, you know their agenda, you know what they want, you know what they need, you know the local players, you know who maybe has behind the scenes power but doesn't talk about it, you're well sourced. You have an amazing arsenal of reporting tools that you can use that someone like me who's working from a national level really doesn't necessarily have it at her fingertips, right? Every time I do a story somewhere, I have to kind of build that. So I think you have a lot of advantages, and the disadvantage you might have is exactly why Fred is asking this question. Where do I look? How do I get started on a story like that? So I'm going to direct you to some really good resources that you may or may not be familiar with. One is the National Institute for Money and State Politics. They run a website called Follow the Money, in which they track political donations that are searchable, that are sortable, that are downloadable at the local, state, and federal level. And another is the Center for Responsive Politics, which tracks federal data and runs a website called Open Secrets that's tremendously useful. Both these groups clean up a lot of data, make it available for reporters to use, will get on the phone with you and help you use it properly, help you find what you're looking for, talk you through the ins and outs of it. They're a tremendous resource. And also, don't ignore your ability to look at original documents. Your state at the, you know, your state has some kind of campaign finance and lobbying disclosure regimen. Every state is different, I regret to tell you. But get to know what it is. Somewhere your local candidates are filing disclosure reports. People who contribute to ballot referendum campaigns are often on disclosure reports. You can look at who's giving money to people, to campaigns, to groups. And then the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, has a website in which you can look at that on the federal level. So what I would suggest, that I know no one has any time and no one has any resources, but take 5 minutes a day for a while. Look at the campaign finance reports that get filed by your congressional delegation and the members you're in a position to cover. Because often when you spot something, it's because you've been looking at those reports over time and you see something that jumps out at you. So look at that. If an outside group comes in and starts buying TV ads in your area, they're filing reports somewhere. Sometimes they're nonprofits and those reports are tax filings that come out years later, but you can look at the tax filings that exist. You can figure out who's on that board. You can look at which contractors they're using. You can find links. You can find out if they're operating from the address of a campaign. You can look at super PAC filings, which, you know, do file information about who's donating to them on the FEC's website and Open Secrets and Follow the Money. Excuse me, can also help you do that. So it's really important to do that blocking and tackling and look at those reports over time, because if you're looking at them regularly, you get more comfortable with them and you sort of avoid those basic mistakes. So I'd recommend starting there.
Carrie, in terms of what you've been noticing over, you know, maybe in recent months, even years, but particularly recently, What trends are you seeing at the national level that maybe, you know, state and local reporters could dig into in terms of where's the money going that maybe it didn't go as much to? Are there issues where, you know, donors seem to be particularly focused these days in a way that a local reporter or a state reporter could you know, localize that kind of trend? More money's going into, you know, any particular issue or initiative?
Oh, that's such a great question, and I love it. For one thing, money is really hard to tie to a particular issue, and this is where we're going to have to get really cynical for a minute, and I'm sorry about that, because I can be kind of a Pollyanna about a lot of things, but this is where we have to get really cynical. So a lot of the money that flows into congressional races around the country and Senate races around the country is because some rich donor somewhere has decided he what he actually really cares about is control of the Senate. He doesn't actually care about who represents you in your congressional district or your state, whatever state that is. I'm sure some days this rich donor can remember and some days that rich donor doesn't care. What he's done is he cares about either Mitch McConnell or Chuck Schumer being in charge of the Senate. That's what he wants. And so what he does is he goes to some big national group and says, okay, I'm going to give you a chunk of money and I want you to spend it on the races that are going to keep my party, my chosen preferred party, in control of X House of Congress. And yes, tell me which ones that is. That's fine. That's great. I'm happy to hear about your red to blue list or your blue to red list or your like path to victory list or whatever it is. But here's the money. And then, you know, in November, I want you to come back to me and tell me we kept control of the Senate or we kept control of the House or we got control of the other one. Mm-hmm. And so often you think to yourself, why is this donor giving money? And sometimes the answer is just that simple. Someone gave him a roadmap and said, if you give me X million, we can hold this seat. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really interesting thing how strategic some of these donors are and how little they actually care about you. I mean, they do not care at all. They do not care at all about you. They do not care at all about that quaint local issue that everyone is really worked up about that they really want the senator to take a position on. And they just don't. And so be open to the possibility that perhaps the super PAC spending money in your race is funded by a bunch of really cynical donors who are looking at a national picture and really care about the position on, like, regulation of this specific area and feel like it's going to be better if X party has control of X House of Congress.
So in other words, they're focused more on the big picture and less on the individual, recipient of their money.
You never know. I mean, back in, actually, this is great. In 2014, I was doing a story on, it was like a profile of a group called Senate Majority PAC, which is still around. And it's basically the Democratic super PAC that spends millions of dollars on Senate races. And in 2014, the Senate was the big prize on the ballot. Everyone was going to control of the Senate. Yeah. The Democrats spent a fortune via Senate Majority PAC trying to keep control of the Senate. And so as part of my reporting, I was calling donors who gave $10,000 or more, which was like dozens and dozens of phone calls, right? My position on these things is you call 100 people and maybe 10 call you back. Mm-hmm. So one of them was an Alaska Native corporation that gave money to Senate Majority PAC. I don't remember how much. They were like a triple digit donor. It was like in the tens of thousands, right?
Right.
And so I called and said, hey, I'm just wondering why you guys decided to give this money. And can you talk to me a little bit about why you gave it to Senate Majority PAC and what's your agenda with the Senate? And I thought they were going to say the obvious, which is the Alaska Senate race.
Right.
Isn't that what you would expect? I was waiting. And they said, oh, no, we really care about Mary Landrieu in Louisiana. And I said, why? Why do you really care about Mary Landrieu in Louisiana? And they said, there's this one very specific piece of legislation that's really going to affect us, and she's sponsoring it, and we really, you know, need it. And I thought, okay, well, I didn't see that one coming, right? Like, I've been covering money in politics for years. No one ever says, I'm giving thousands of dollars to elect the senator because there's one bill I really need over the law.
Yeah.
You're really not supposed to say that out loud. Yeah.
So do those make good stories, Carrie, those kinds of things that you unexpectedly run into?
I think they kind of do, you know, like I think it goes to show you too, the cosmic picture to keep in mind as you're reporting these stories from a local level, which is congressional and Senate races have really been nationalized in a bunch of different ways. They've been nationalized to big donors who care about control of the Senate, but also over the last, I'd say 4 years, what we've seen is they've really been nationalized to small donors. And you really saw that in 2018 when on the Democratic side, Act Blue just unleashed an absolute flood of money from mostly small dollar donors, right? Not all of them, but most of them, who looked around the country and said, my Senate race is pretty safe. And where can I give money that's going to matter? And we actually did an analysis of that and found out that $1 out of every $3 that went to Democratic House and Senate candidates through Act Blue came from New York and California, I think was the number. It was $1 out of every $3 to candidates anywhere in the country.
Right.
And so that was the Democratic ATM. You had a bunch of Democrats on the coast who looked around and said, I'm fighting mad about Trump. I don't like his administration. I'm going to give money, and I really care if we pick up the Senate seat or House seat in Kentucky.
Right, right.
And that's what I can do. I can't go to Kentucky and volunteer, so I'm going to give $25. And so you just really saw this nationalization of congressional races that used to be local. And I think that that's a big change to look at. And it's, I say that in a way that's value neutral. It's not good. It's not bad. It just is.
Right. Right.
I think you see it happening with the Republicans too.
Right. Right. So here's a question that I actually may take a crack at myself. It's something I deal with all the time. Questioner asks, why is there such a disconnect between the stock market good and the economy bad these days? It is a great question.
Why?
We you know, the stock market averages, you know, are hitting records or nearing records. And here we are in the grip of what we're told is a horrendous recession. What the heck is going on? So here's what's going on. And it's actually pretty simple. The stock market doesn't care about what's happening right now. It never has. The stock market is always concerned with what it thinks is going to happen next month, next year, or even 2 years from now. So what is going on now is there are glimmers, just glimmers of hope as the economy gradually reopens and businesses reopen, and as the Federal Reserve provides more stimulus, you know, through its various lending programs and borrowing rates, that things will eventually get better. And as a result, companies will be able to make more money and therefore justify higher stock prices. And that's why people buy stocks and drive stocks higher. So again, it's not, the economy is what's going on right now, where we got high unemployment, people are suffering. It's a very grim picture right now. But the market, in theory, has always already baked in everything that exists now, all the information that is currently available. So every time some new little piece of information emerges that the market takes hope from, it sees it as a reason to either, you know, to buy if it is hopeful, or if it's a negative thing to sell. So we're in a weird, very weird dynamic now, where we have the economy, which is struggling terribly, although we did have a somewhat, you know, we had a positive jobs report that was a surprise on Friday. It did show that the trend may be moving in the right direction, although there's reason to doubt that it's going to be sustained. But again, the market is always seeing anything that suggests improvement ahead as a reason to go higher. So I hope that answers that question. And then related real quick, was there too much focus on the headline number in the jobs report last Friday? Not enough on some of you may have heard there was a note in the report which suggested that the unemployment rate actually would have been higher had the government counted people properly. And just to summarize real quick, what happened was people who are classified as absent from work are supposed to be categorized as unemployed. But what happened was the census takers who compiled this data counted these people. These are people who were told, you know, we're letting you go temporarily, we're furloughing you, we don't know how long you're going to be out, but we're going to bring you back relatively soon. That group of people should have been counted as unemployed because they don't have a job right now, even though they expect to come back soon, eventually. But instead, they were counted as employed. So if they had been properly counted as unemployed, the unemployment rate would actually have been 3 points higher than it was. It would have been in the 16% range rather than 13% range. And the same was true the previous month. In fact, the disparity was even greater in April. It would have been 5 points higher. Anyway, to simplify all of that, the unemployment rates for the previous 2 months should arguably have been higher than they were reported. But since they both suffered from the same information gathering error, it was apples to apples. And so the number on Friday was reported as what the government gave us, which was 13.3% rather than 16.3%. So it will be an apples and apples comparison with April. There's hope that in the next jobs report, all this will be remedied and the correct unemployment rate will be produced that would really reflect the number of people who are unemployed. So anyway, I hope that answers that question. Do either of you want to add anything to that in terms of how you're approaching these questions, or anything that relates to how your reporters are dealing with the economy or the unemployment situation?
Well, the problem with a lot of the furlough stuff is that, you know, it's quite possible to game the system. As a matter of fact, if you call Iowa Workforce Development, our labor department here in Iowa, they'll even suggest you do this. If you can space out your furlough so that you take maybe one day a week as opposed to taking the full week, and stretch that out over several weeks, they say, they'll tell you, you can collect that $600 in furlough.
Interesting.
Every day you take off. So counting people who are doing that has got to be a tremendous challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's so much of what we call noise, you know, that's a term we use a lot, in, you know, in terms of how the government reports economic data. And we're in one of those periods of time because of the pandemic and because of these unusual furloughs, temporary job cuts. All of these things are very, very difficult to sort of synthesize properly in a short period of time. I don't think there was any malfeasance. I know there was all kinds of suspicion that maybe the government was playing with the numbers. We don't think that's the case. It's just the difficulty of carrying out a monumental task every month. It leads to these kinds of problems. So anyway, Carrie, did you want to add anything to that, or is that?
Only that it speaks to a larger point that we all have to remember as reporters, whether we're covering, you know, the latest unemployment numbers or campaign finance data, which is, you need to make sure you understand what's in your number. And so I've had this come up with money and politics data in a lot of ways, because there's a lot of ways to get it wrong. There's a lot of ways to read too much into it. There's a lot of ways to report a number without context. And so if you're going to wade into that kind of data, I would just say, remember what you already know, which is that if you're reporting a number, you need to know the assumptions that went into creating it, and you need to know what it's measuring, and you need to know the caveats. And so I think that that's really true with politics too. I've seen a lot of people wade different kinds of money and politics numbers around that turn out to be not quite right or tricky or, and so I think just be aware of how you're framing it. And if you find yourself writing around something, then stop.
Right, right. Here's a query that came in from one of the participants. It relates to proposals for tax law changes. During the Democratic primaries, of course, there was a lot of attention paid to the wealth tax. It was one of Elizabeth Warren's, you know, issues. Some of the other candidates may also have, you know, backed some form of it as well. The wealth tax, there are various iterations of it. We haven't heard very much of it since the Democratic primary season kind of came to a close. Do we expect that issue to you know, reassert itself in the general election? Will Joe Biden perhaps, or his supporters, make it an issue? And if so, is there a strategy for covering such tax changes? Bill, you want to jump in, or Carrie, either one?
Maybe a question of who gets the vice presidential nomination and how strong they were on that issue. It did not seem to be a powerful part of Biden's campaign.
Right.
It was out there.
Right. And before I go to Carrie, you know, one way to think of this, and this the questioner even added this as part of the question, is we're in this mode now, it seems, where the federal government, because of the economic emergency we find ourselves in, is paying very little attention to how much money it's spending. You know, it's like, let's spend now and worry about how to pay for it later. And I think there's very little disagreement with that right now, just because of how dire the economic situation is. Should that also be the case with the wealth tax? I mean, if the wealth tax comes up again in the general election, is it a legitimate question to say, well, how are you going to pay for that if we're not worried about how we're paying for all these stimulus programs and in some cases bailout programs that are being allocated now by the federal government? How do we approach this as journalists covering the political season? Carrie?
Well, first of all, I think the tax policy changes during the Trump administration passed by Congress, the new tax law, were something the Trump administration considered a signature achievement. And so I think that we are going to hear about tax policy during this election. Because at the time, that law got a lot of criticism because its benefits accrued disproportionately to the wealthy. And Democrats have said that they would change some of that. Now, there's popular parts of that law that, in all honesty, there's probably no political will to reverse. But I think that that tax law was, and I'm glad you brought it up, a very key policy change for the business community. They fought for it. They lobbied for it. They spent a fortune electing politicians who would support it. They courted those politicians in a variety of different ways. And they got the tax law, and they are not going to want to see it rolled back should there be a change in administration or a change in control of Congress. They're going to fight to keep the pieces of it that are important to them. And I think some of it, the international tax provisions and other things, are a really big, big policy issue for big business. So I do think this is going to be an issue either during the period leading up to the election or afterward, when either the Trump administration or a new administration looks to define its tax policy. I do think it's an open question as to how much the wealth tax and other tax policy issues are going to dominate the conversation right now, when there's a pandemic, when the economy is maybe slowing its free fall, but coming out of a pretty big collapse and an abrupt collapse. What people are going to want to talk about, you know, if you had asked me 6 months ago, my answer would have been pretty different than if you asked me today. And so I think there's a Ouija board or a magic eight ball in the house somewhere. And honestly, their opinion is probably just as valid as mine. Because it's, you know, this year has taken a lot of twists and turns so far, and I bet there'll be more between now and November.
Yeah.
But what I will say is that how the government pays for things has always been an issue. Tax policy has always been an issue, right? Death and taxes. So I'm pretty sure this is going to come up. I'm pretty sure there's going to be daylight between Trump and Biden on it. And again, this is something the business community does not want to lose. But as Bill pointed out, you know, there's been a lot of things that the federal government has thrown money at lately, and eventually someone is going to have to start talking about the fact that they need to pay for things, I assume. And so how they do that is going to be an issue. And I think one thing that I have found, and I am not a tax policy expert, but one thing that I have found is that once someone targets a tax break, and puts it on the table, or targets a tax provision, puts it on the table, maybe writes some legislative language around it, when a member of Congress has something they want and goes looking for a pay for to put into the bill, those things tend to be really convenient and they're just lying around. So I want to say I've been hearing about the carried interest tax break for private equity for over a decade,
oh,
right?
Sure.
And somehow, despite the many, many, many rounds of lobbying, despite the legislative language that's been drafted, somehow that has survived. But a lot of things don't make it forever. And so eventually, you know, mortality is something that can apply to tax breaks and to tax expenditures. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens with this. I would be lying if I said that I knew.
So, Bill, in a state like Iowa, what do you think, there's a political appetite if Biden were to go in there and say, let's roll back the Trump tax cuts, which were so disproportionately skewed in favor of wealthy individuals and corporations? Do you think there'd be a public response to that, a positive response to that, or is it uncharted territory because it still could be portrayed as tax increase?
There's a lot of farmers who own a lot of land. They may not look like they're rich people on the face of it, but they're pretty rich, and they're very happy with the tax cuts as they are.
Mm, interesting.
So I'm not sure that's a.
So that's not a winner. That's not a political.
I don't think it's a winner here. I really don't.
And I think there would be an argument in a lot of places about increasing taxes on employers right now when you're trying to get people back to work, right?
Sure, good point.
Job creation, but I can see the tenor of that conversation shifting at some point. The question is when.
Right, right. Very good. Yeah. Well, this is all, I mean, this is all going to play out in ways that none of us can possibly predict. I'm sure we will be surprised in innumerable ways over the next several months between now and November 3rd. We're right up against the end of our allotted time for this webinar. So, you know, I just want to say thank you very much to Bill and Carrie and to the SABU organizers. And Matthew, I don't know if Matthew wanted to say a few closing words, or
yeah, absolutely. Just want a sincere thank you to Fred, Carrie, and Bill. This has been a great, very useful presentation. To our listeners, watch your email for more information about SABU's next monthly training session. Finally, if you have a suggestion about a future training topic, please email Cebu at cebu.org. This concludes today's session. Thanks again, everyone.
Thank you.
And thanks to Bill and Fred.
Absolutely.
Happy to do it. Thank you.